officially by international cell phone time. All right, we just quickly reminding you of what we've been talking about. We talked a little bit about membrane electrodes, and in the context we're talking about potentiometry. We discussed the fact that it's a two-electrode system. We need a reference electrode. We talked about reference electrodes. Then we started to talk about indicator electrodes. We began with metallic indicator electrodes, first kind. We dealt with insoluble species or a metal in contact with its insoluble salt. We called that an electrode of the second kind. We talked about inert metallic electrodes. We got on to membrane electrodes. We talked about the glass membrane electrode, and this is a review of that, or just a reminder slide indicating that the membrane, of course, is this part down here. I think I like red better. The color is red. And so the membrane, and then inside is pretty standard silver wire. It's got silver chloride coated onto it. It also has a filling solution of 0.1 molar HCl. It responds to hydrogen ion based on the chemistry of the membrane, of the glass surface. We develop a Nernstein response, although there's no E0 for hydrogen ion in a glass electrode setting. And so we develop a Nernstein response. We couple that with a reference electrode, and we end up with a combination device, combination pH electrode, as is shown here. The outer portion is the reference. Okay, out here is the reference filling solution, the porous junction. Air and lead are also where you fill the electrode, and that has a silver wire that's wrapped around this inner glass tube. Inside of that, of course, is where the pH electrode, the actual glass electrode, is housed in the glass, connected to the glass bulb and so forth. And then we talked about liquid membrane electrode. So we had a glass membrane electrode, liquid membrane electrode. I gave you the example of the calcium electrode. I brought today a nitrate electrode because I happened to find it in my lab this morning. And this one's kind of cool. It's a little newer than the one that I showed you yesterday. So you unscrew this and look at that little electrode inside of there. Really cool. And so and obviously there's rubber over top of the membrane, and I don't know, I just happened to find it in my lab, so I brought it in. So we have here a liquid ion exchanger, a liquid material. It says here, water immiscible organic complex, phosphate groups bind calcium, and so this is why we would do that for calcium type electrodes. And we do have an actual polymer membrane here that holds in place that liquid ion exchanger. And it's a porous membrane, and so things diffuse through it without any trouble. And then they get in contact with that liquid material, which forms a membrane of sorts. And away we go with a liquid membrane electrode. We then, I mentioned different types of electrodes that are called solid state membrane electrodes. Whole new membrane, it's a crystal. They actually grow these things in sheets, okay? And then they cut them out with cookie cutters. Little Santa Clauses, little angels, no. They just grow them in sheets, and they cut them out with a circular die and put them on the surface of these electrodes. And you know, probably cost next to nothing to grow these things, right? You cut out those crystals and they're selling these electrodes. I might have paid, the last one I bought, I might have paid about $400 for. And again, it's probably about $4 worth of material. But it has to be an ionic conductor. The membrane is the critical part of that. The rest of it is anybody can, you know, build in the lab, no problem. Growing that crystal is going to take a lot of trial and error in appropriate conditions. And again, mixed crystals tend to work better. A lot of this is determined by trial and error. We have various membranes, various solid state membranes that can be used for different ions. These are the these are the primary ones that are listed in this list here. There are some others, but these are the ones that are kind of used all the time and readily available, and you'll see in common usage. We got into permeable membrane electrodes, or gas permeable membrane, or gas sensing electrodes, whatever you want to call them, okay? And this is a nothing more than a pH electrode covered with a membrane. Now, the pH electrode, we all talked about how it has to be hydrated and so forth, so there's got to be a solution around this pH electrode, so we got to have a means of holding a solution. One way of doing that is to take something as simple as a Kim wipe, a laboratory tissue, and soak it in a solution and slap it on top of the glass electrode, then put the membrane over top of it, wrap a rubber band around it to hold it in place, and you have a membrane electrode. And literally, this is how people developed these kinds of membrane electrodes. I mentioned for you the device chemistry behind the system for an ammonia electrode. It's going to sense ammonia. Okay, ammonia is a gas. It's a neutral molecule. It's going to pass through that polymeric membrane that is a hydrophobic membrane. Solution is not porous like it was in the last example. Solution is not passing through this. Water beads up on the surface of a hydrophobic polymeric membrane, and as the water is repelled, only a neutral molecule, like a gas molecule, like a ammonia molecule, or some other neutral species, can pass through it. You know, oxygen passes through a lot of membranes. Teflon is very permeable to oxygen. Again, you go to the polymer people and you say, "Build me a membrane, or make me, give me some membranes. What do you got?" Oh, we got a whole list of things here, and we make a nice thin film, and we test it to determine what it's permeable to. So we find one that is very permeable to ammonia, and we put that over a pH electrode. We started out this way, but later on we got a little more sophisticated, and we got ourselves a flat-surfaced pH electrode. So the glass bulb, the sensing tip of the pH electrode is nice and flat. We put a little filling solution somehow. The Kim wipe is one way that I've seen done. And then we put the membrane over top of that, and voila, that's French. Okay, voila, you have a membrane electrode, a gas permeable membrane electrode. And we talked about the chemistry a little bit. The idea that, of course, this is the reaction I showed you. It has a KB because ammonia is a base. And it produces, the reaction of ammonia with water produces hydroxide ion. We can sense hydroxide ion with a pH electrode indirectly by measuring the hydrogen ion concentration and knowing the KW for water. So pretty simple stuff. We rearrange the KB in terms of the ion that we're interested in. This part of the equation is essentially constant. This, of course, is a constant that we know, and we said we fixed the ammonium ion concentration. We put in some known fairly high concentration of ammonium ion, and now we have a system, so this kind of drops out or stays constant, and we have a system where ammonia is proportional, the concentration of ammonia is proportional to the hydroxide ion, or we rewrite that in terms of the KW, 14 minus negative log of the hydrogen ion activity is the pH, negative log of the hydroxide ion concentration would be pOH, and therefore 14 minus pOH is equal to, the pH is equal to 14 minus pOH, which is proportional to or equal to the negative log of the ammonia concentration. So we got a system for ammonia. And fairly simple. Now, if I can do it for ammonia, I can do it for carbon dioxide. All right? And so we have a CO2 gas sensing probe. And this one is not the Kim wipe over the glass electrode, but it's almost the same. And what we've got here is that this part right here is my pH electrode. And then At the tip, the part that was blue is now red. Okay, so this is my sensing tip, and then it's in some kind of a little reservoir. All right, and the reservoir, there's a membrane out here. Okay, there's a membrane. Now, one little thing, the reason I put this diagram in here is because I glossed over one minor detail. The minor detail, based on my little pH electrode with the Kim wipe and the Saran wrap or whatever you want to put over it as a membrane, won't work. Because I told you that the polymer membrane is hydrophobic. That means it isolates the glass electrode from the reference electrode. There's now a barrier between my two half cells. My glass electrode half cell and my reference electrode half cell are now isolated. Let's say I isolated the glass electrode by putting a piece of plastic over it and wrapping a rubber band around it and sealing it off from the solution. There's no electrical contact there. It won't work that way. You actually have to put the piece of Saran wrap over the entire end of the combination electrode, including the reference junction, the junction for the reference, so that there is electrical contact between the reference electrode and the glass electrode. So this diagram fixes that problem. Okay, it fixes that problem because behind the membrane, where the, you know, in this case CO2 is diffusing into this filling solution, all this gray area is filling solution, right up here is my reference electrode. And, you know, it can be pretty simple by putting just a silver wire with some, you know, silver chloride, you know, that's what it says, it's an AGG, into this filling solution. I got to have some chloride in my filling solution to make the reference electrode work properly, and I'm all set. So I got my reference taken care of over here. I've got my pH sensing device here, and then I've got my membrane down at the bottom here, my membrane where material is going to pass through, and I'm all set. Right? In this case, it's a different principle of operation, right? We know that, what do we know? Carbonic acid, H2CO3, dissociates to give you H plus plus bicarbonate, and then bicarbonate dissociates to give you H plus plus CO3 2 minus, and we're interested in CO2. Oh, I forgot about CO2. CO2 plus H2O yields H2CO3. So that here. Okay, and so if I'm interested in measuring CO2, then based on this reaction, or this series of reactions, then I can measure the CO2 that diffuses into my enclosed little system here by measuring the pH of that system. This is a direct response to hydrogen ion, whereas in the ammonia case, it was an indirect response to hydroxide ion. But it's just a change in pH, and we're sensing that with the pH electrode. So, very, very simple system. We have several systems that work along those lines. Commercial gas sensing electrodes are available, as we said, for ammonia, as we said, for carbon dioxide, also for hydrogen cyanide, HCN. Well, it's an acid, it's also a gas, right? And it gives rise to a proton, but it also gives rise, so you could measure it by the H+, but actually the scheme that's used is a cyanide electrode, okay? I told you before when I talked about solid-state electrodes, I believe that there was a cyanide electrode. We can measure HCN with that electrode. Hydrofluoric acid, we can measure with a fluoride electrode. You say you could also measure it with an H-plus electrode. Not really, because HF dissolves glass. So if you stuck a glass electrode, a very thin glass membrane, into a solution of hydrofluoric acid, bye-bye. So you need to have a fluoride electrode to measure hydrofluoric acid. You can develop a membrane electrode, a gas permeable membrane electrode for H2S based on this reaction. The thing is, there's a solid state electrode for sulfide, because a lot of sulfide forms a lot of insoluble salts. So you can make a solid state membrane electrode for sulfide, and they work really well. If I've got a really good solid state membrane electrode, I'm probably better off than a gas permeable membrane electrode. Solid state electrodes are really rugged, work real well. Gas sensing electrodes, they're a little bit delicate, right? You mess up that little membrane on the end, you know, you poke a hole in it, you get it dirty, it's not going to work anymore. You got to change the membrane. That becomes a little bit difficult. The membranes are small. The devices are a little bit complex. Solid state indicator electrodes are very simple, very rugged, usually require little or no maintenance. Occasionally you polish the solid state membrane. And so you're probably better off with sulfide to do a solid state solid state membrane electrode rather than a gas sensing electrode. And then you can get it for SO2 and NO2 as well. Based on different principles, this one's actually pH. These three are pH. Others have different types of electrode systems that are available. And then what's this one? Immobilized nitrate. So the electrode I passed around to you is a nitrate electrode, and that's what they're talking about, nitrate here. Okay, let me give you one more. Yeah, just one more. One more type of membrane electrode that is based on the systems that we just talked about, and that's the enzyme electrode. An enzyme electrode is often a membrane electrode based on the gas permeable membrane electrode that we just talked about. The example is the urea electrode, okay? Urea, shown here, okay, can break down to give you two ammonia molecules and a CO2 molecule. Wow, I've got two choices. I can either measure the urea breakdown with an ammonia gas sensing electrode, gas permeable membrane electrode, or I could measure it with a CO2 gas permeable membrane electrode. The reality is that being an analytical type person and thinking sensitivity, I realized that since I get two ammonia molecules for each urea, I have a twofold improvement in sensitivity if I'm measuring ammonia. Okay, so we'll go with ammonia, but you can do it either way. Now, the reason that this is an enzyme electrode is because urea doesn't break down very rapidly by itself. You got to give it a push, okay? You got to give it a catalyst. An enzyme is a catalyst. So I build an electrode with an enzyme in it, and I put it in contact with urea. It breaks down the urea, causes or catalyzes the breakdown of the urea, and gives me the species that I can measure. So what do? I get the same gas permeable membrane electrode that I used for ammonia. This is it right here, okay? Same exact one, but I add to it an enzyme layer, okay? An enzyme layer. This is my rendition of an enzyme layer right here. Little hairs, okay? Little hairs growing off the end of the electrode. The electrode didn't shave this morning. What do we do? How do you immobilize an enzyme? A lot of different ways. You can just adsorb it. In other words, stick it in a solution of the enzyme. That's not really a good way to do it. It'll wash off quite easily. You could ion exchange it on there. Put some kind of a cationic group maybe on the surface of the membrane. Use a membrane that has a cationic surface or has grafted cationic groups, and then stick it in a solution of the enzyme, which may be negatively charged. Truthfully, the enzyme is probably amphiphilic. It has both positive and negative charges, but it depends on the pH of your system. It may be negatively charged or positively charged. But you could ion exchange it to the surface of the electrode. not really that good of a way, because again it will wash off or will be exchanged by other ions. The best way to immobilize an enzyme is to covalently attach it. And one of the great reagents that's used is glutaraldehyde. Glutaraldehyde is a carbon chain with two aldehyde groups, one at each end, and you can perform shift-based type condensation reactions to attach the glutaraldehyde to a membrane surface and to the enzyme. And you can have a covalently attached enzyme molecule, again, as shown is by little hairs at the surface of my electrode. So, what happens? Urea comes along. You stick the electrode in a solution that has some urea in it. The urea molecule comes along, gets in contact with these little enzyme molecules that are hanging off the membrane. And again, we can get some help if you're not synthetically inclined. By the way, this is simple synthetic chemistry. Okay, why? Because you know, remember organic chemistry lab, and you had to react things, and then you had to isolate, crystallize, purify your. You don't have to do that with these. Once you perform the reaction, you just wash the electrode off, and you're done. Okay, it's my kind of organic chemistry. Right. So you attach the. You can get some help though. Synthetic type people to help you attach this. You don't want to denature the enzyme in the process of attaching it, but it's attached, and you stick it in the solution, and a urea molecule comes along, gets associated with these enzyme molecules, breaks down. This reaction occurs. We produce some ammonia. Since we made it out of an ammonia electrode, the ammonia diffuses through the membrane, okay, into the little filling solution in there, and causes a pH change. We measure the pH change. We are able to get some idea of what the concentration of urea is. You say, some idea? I want to know exactly. Okay, then calibrate the electrode. Set yourself up a series of standards of urea. Put the electrode in each standard, develop a calibration curve, and then go to your unknown solutions, and you'll be able to determine the urea with this enzyme electrode. Simple as that. Okay, simple as that. Which may not be all that simple, but it works. Okay, it works. Alright, let me just, by way of conclusion, remind you of a few things. One is that electrochemistry that is of the nature of potentiometry is based on a galvanic cell, so we just need an electrochemical cell, two half cells, appropriately put together with a device for measuring the potential. It will develop a potential because we've pre-selected. In other words, we know what systems will work and develop a potential for us. Then we are able to select or use those systems and come up with a measurement for the particular species of interest. So it's an electrochemical cell. It works based on the Nernst equation, and you can measure a variety of things along the Nernstian response, in other words, the slope of 0.0591 over n. There is essentially no current flow or extremely low current flow. Why is that? Well, remember, we used an electrometer which has a very high input impedance, 100 megaohms. So current can't flow. There's a very high resistance to flow. That's good, because if current was flowing in the system, the electrochemical cell would be changing. All right, the concentrations would be changing as current flows in the system. We don't want the concentration of the species to change. We want to know what they are now. If we perturb the system, what good is that? You come to somebody and they say, I want to know what the concentration is. You say, well, it used to be something, but I know what it is now. I changed it. I don't want to change it. I want to keep it the same. And so I don't want current flowing to any appreciable extent. So that in a potentiometric system, no current. That's important, because in the next kind of system we talk about, there will be current flowing. Okay, requires a conductive solution. So you need supporting electrolyte. You need to have ions. Making measurements in distilled water just doesn't cut it in potentiometry. When you make a pH measurement of your distilled water solution, You just distilled water to get laboratory pure water, and you try to measure the pH of it, it's not going to give you a really accurate reading. Now, after the solution comes in contact with carbon dioxide and it becomes a dilute carbonic acid solution or bicarbonate solution, then it'll have a few ions in there, but huge junction potential, not a great way to do it. Best way to do it, add some inert, non-reactive supporting electrolyte, something that's going to allow ions to be conducted in the solution. Okay, we do need to measure, use a laboratory pH millivolt meter, or I called it an electrometer, and it says here capable of measuring 0.1 millivolts. You can do it with a device that measures 1 millivolt. Some genius many years ago, probably 20 years ago before I was here, ordered a whole bunch of meters, like 20 of them, for the undergraduate laboratory, and got a good deal because they didn't measure to 0.1 millivolt. So the students, if you take the Nernst equation and you assume an N of 2, okay, there are an awful lot of N is equal to 2 systems, and you look at an uncertainty of plus or minus 1 millivolt or 0.001 in E, you will find out that 0.4 times N we said was 2, percent. Alright, that's almost, again, from the Nernst equation, the uncertainty, if you have an uncertainty of 1 millivolt, it translates to a percentage uncertainty of 0.4 times N percent. Right? That's a bit of a problem. Okay. Did I say 1? I meant to say, okay, 0.1. 0.1 corresponds to 0.4 times N. 1 millivolt plus or minus 1 millivolt translates to 4% times N. Okay? So if you have a plus or minus 1, and if N is equal to 1, you're plus or minus 4%. If N is equal to 2, you're plus or minus 8%. If you're an analytical chemist, you're probably looking for a new job, okay? Because that's lousy, right? I want to be down here. I want to be less than 1%. I lectured to the undergraduates yesterday and told them, as an analytical chemist, if I can do things better than 1%, most of the time I'm doing okay. Okay? My pipettes in the laboratory, they're good to a little bit better than 1%. You know, my micropipettes and so forth. When I get way down to, a few microliters, it gets slightly above 1%. But my analytical balance, okay, much better than 1% accuracy and precision. If I'm above, if I'm in the 4 to 8% range, it stinks. Okay, now, some systems, you can't get any better than that. Or you have cumulative errors in the process that you had to go through to analyze something, and the end result is it's a few percent error. Okay, but here the measurement process alone, the basis of my measurement is already off by 4% for N is equal to 1 if I'm only reading plus or minus 1 millivolt. So I need a meter that reads plus or minus 0.1 millivolts. Right? And the meters that read to the thousandths of a pH unit also read to 0.1 millivolts. The same thing, okay? We don't so much need it for pH measurements, unless you're going to do really super accurate pH measurements, but we do need it for ion selective electrode measurements like the ones that we talked about. I mentioned before that electrodes measure activity, not concentration. This is a general theme throughout all of electrochemistry. It's not really concentration we're measuring, it is activity. We need to know the difference, and we can take care of that. Of course, we know how to calculate activity versus concentration. We can measure some things in dilute solutions. We can calibrate and in systems of similar ionic strength and remove this activity problem, or maybe it's not a problem. But we measure activity, not concentration. for the first 8 years after my professional life, when I got out of graduate school, I worked at the New England Aquarium in Boston in the research department. We measured, all the stuff we did was in seawater. Seawater is not a dilute solution. It's 3.5% salt. Okay, it's not ideal. The activity differs substantially from concentration. So you need to really concern yourself with that. Another related concept is the idea that in electrochemistry, we measure free or uncomplexed ions. If I were to measure, we had a lead electrode the other day. If I reacted that lead with EDTA, as we often do in a complexometric titration, I form a lead EDTA complex. It happens to be a 1-to-1 stoichiometry. I left off the charges. EDTA is 4-. The point is that if I have that equilibrium in my sample, and I put an electrode, a lead solid-state membrane electrode in there to measure the lead concentration, I will measure this stuff right here. Okay? I will not measure this stuff over here. Why? It's not lead. It's lead EDTA. It's something different. It's actually chemically different than lead ion. The electrode does not respond. The electrode is designed to respond to lead ion and not to lead EDTA. Now, I told you there were selectivity coefficients and things going on in there that the electrode will respond. In reality, the electrode probably has some response to this, but it is vastly less sensitive to the lead EDTA than it is to lead. And so this is, again, a recurring theme in electrochemistry. The electrodes measure the free ion. If the ion is bound up in some kind of an insoluble species, a complex ion pair, whatever, the response of the electrode is either going to be zero or substantially diminished. And now, is this a problem? Well, it could be. Remember the guy who made millions discovering this sodium electrode? Took a problem, made it into a solution. Same can go for this. The idea that I measure the free ion could be good. Could be something that allows me to make a measurement that I can't make in other ways. It's not easy to measure. So the free lead ion is not easy to measure by other methods, but it can be measured electrochemically. If I go to atomic absorption, I got an atomic absorption instrument, or an ICP mass spec, or graphite furnace AA, or whatever it is that I have to measure lead, it measures total lead. If I put this system into the instrument, I get the sum of the free lead and the lead EDTA. The atomic absorption instrument doesn't know the difference between lead ion and lead EDTA complex. It burns the whole thing up. It's kind of a brute force technique, destructive. Okay, it burns the sample up, all right, in a flame, and you measure the absorbance of the lead. The EDTA has been burned to a crisp. Okay, it's not there anymore, and we get total lead measurements. ICP mass spec, all these things will measure the total lead in that system. But electrochemical measurements will measure the free lead ion. Well, we could combine the two methods and define our system and determine the equilibrium constant, determine the total amount of lead in the system, determine the free lead, by difference determine the lead complex. It could help us define the system chemically. So the fact that these devices, these potentiometric electrodes is what we're talking about, measure free or uncomplexed metals and not total ions is maybe an advantage. Now, if I had the lead EDTA system that I just erased, okay, what I could do is I could chemically alter this system to convert the lead EDTA. I could drive the reaction this way, convert all of the lead, in other words, add a whole bunch of acid. All right, EDTA is a tetraprotic acid, and if I add enough acid to it, it'll break up this complex and drive the reaction this way and make all the lead free. And then I could measure the by chemically altering the system, I could make all of the lead free and measure it with my electrode. So I could still get the total measurement with my electrode if I'm a little bit savvy about my chemistry. If I do, I manipulate my chemistry to convert the stuff to a free ion, total equals free, I'm all set to measure with my electrode. So this may be an advantage. It gives you a perspective on things that you can't get by other methods. Before I go on to that voltammetry, let me mention one more thing that I just happened to remember when I was looking at the one of the previous slides, this slide right here. I made a deal about this funny looking electrode, this flat sensing electrode, and the reason I did that is because with all membrane electrodes, okay, and there's membrane electrodes are used for several things, as we pointed out. They're also used in voltammetry that we're going to talk about next sometimes. It's a little esoteric, special case kind of situation. But membrane electrodes are important, yet they have certain properties that are different than other electrodes. And one of them, as I look at this diagram, it reminds me that the species that are going to be sensed by this electrode must diffuse through a membrane. That takes time. They must diffuse through a membrane, and they must react in a they must equilibrate or react in that little solution layer, this little gray layer right here, before they come in contact with the surface of the electrode. So this takes time, and there's no stirring in there, right? So the reason I made this flat was so that this layer could be minimized in volume, okay? That the distance, remember I showed you this diagram? Okay, right here. Well, when the stuff comes in through the membrane, it's got to get across this distance right here to get to the electrode surface. That takes time. And unless I'm somehow stirring the solution in here, that might be tricky, okay? There's a response time different. Remember I told you before, potentiometric electrodes have response time related to the activity of the species of interest. Well, that's true. I wasn't talking about membrane electrodes. Now I'm adding in an additional time, the time it takes for the material first to diffuse across the membrane, second to react or diffuse or equilibrate in the solution, the filling solution behind the membrane. This is significant. And using the geometry, a thin layer promotes the diffusion or makes the diffusion less, the distance that it has to travel. We'll talk about diffusion coefficients maybe in a few minutes. But the idea is that response time for membrane electrodes is slower than regular potentiometric electrodes, and anything that you can do to enhance the diffusion or enhance mass transport, in other words, moving the ion of interest across the membrane through the tests, through the filling solution to the sensing electrode, will facilitate or speed up your measurements. Okay, so that's just a concept, a point I wanted to mention as I happen to think about it. All right, we are now going to change gears, okay, into the area of voltammetry. Voltammetry is different than potentiometry, and remember I told you in the first class that if there's one thing I wanted you to understand is the difference between potentiometry and voltammetry. I try by saying, okay, from physical chemistry, we're still going to use an electrochemical cell, we're still going to use two half cells to make a voltammetric electrochemical system, but it's no longer a galvanic cell that spontaneously produces a potential and allows us to measure that with a voltmeter of sorts, an electrometer, potentiometer. But now I have an electrolytic cell. I must electrolyze the solution, okay? I must supply energy and cause an oxidation reaction to occur or cause a reduction reaction to occur. This is the primary difference between voltammetry and potentiometry, and I need you to understand that because you need to know what you're doing. If you are doing electrochemistry, you need to know the kind of electrochemistry you're doing, because the equipment is totally different. You cannot do voltammetry with a laboratory pH meter. It just won't work. It's just going to sit there and look at you and say, hey, stupid. Okay, you need some power. Okay, this just measures voltage. You need power. You need something to electrolyze the system. So voltammetry is based on an electrolytic cell. Usually, we apply a potential. So we have a battery or some power supply, and we apply a potential to the electrodes, and we cause the oxidation reduction reaction to occur. And as that reaction occurs, we measure the current. Okay, we measure current. Does it say that here somewhere? It doesn't say that. It says apply potential or current to the electrodes. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Oh, here it is, down here. Okay, measure the current. Now, there are cases where we can apply current, constant current, to the system. These are rare. Okay, there's only a couple of examples, and so don't get too worried about it. But there are some examples where we apply a current. Well, if you apply a current, there's also a voltage or potential? Yes, there is. But it depends on what we're controlling. In most voltammetry, we control the potential and we measure the current. In some cases, we control the current. Yes, there's a potential, but we measure the potential. We don't control it. We allow it to go to whatever value it will seek on its own, and so we measure that potential or voltage. But that's a rare case. Okay, that's a rare case. Most of the time, it's apply a potential or control the potential and measure the current that's produced. Now, let's see. That's all due to oxidation and reduction, so we got to remember Leo Gurr, right? Lose electrons, oxidation; gain electrons, reduction. We can have two electrodes. That's simple. I'll start with two electrodes, okay? We'll take it to some baby steps. But then we'll go to a three-electrode system. Complicated. What do you do with that third electrode? Stick it in your ear. No. You have three electrodes sometimes, and it'll become obvious. It'll be simple. I'll explain it. I have this incredible knack for making things so incredibly simple that you understand everything I'm talking about. Never mind. All right, so anyway, some of the systems are going to be stirred. Sometimes we're going to stir the system in order to facilitate the mass transport, right? We got to get things from the... Electrochemistry takes place at the electrode surface. This is not an electrode, but it will suffice for the moment. It takes place at the electrode surface. It is not a magic wand that has magical powers emanating from it. Okay, there is not a force field involved where things are occurring at some distance from the electrode due to a magical emanating force coming from the electrode surface. Uh-uh. It all takes place right at the surface. The species of interest, the molecule or ion, must come in contact with the electrode in order for the reaction to occur. All the rest of the solution is just there for looks, to supply the ions and molecules that are going to react. But the actual electrochemical reaction takes place at the surface of the electrode. Okay, what else? That's good enough for this slide. All right, let's move on. In all electrochemical methods, if we're causing an oxidation and a reduction to occur, as is stated here, then there is a rate for that reaction to take place. So just like any chemistry, any chemical reaction, there's a rate of that reaction. Could be fast, could be slow. In electrochemistry, if the reaction, the rate at which the reaction takes place is dependent on two things. Okay, there are two things that two general concepts here that control how fast the oxidation or reduction reaction is going to occur at that electrode surface. One of them is so simple, it's the rate and means by which the material reaches the electrode surface. It's the mass transport. Okay, the ion has got to get to the surface somehow. It could take a plane. It could take a bus. It could take a train. But it doesn't. Okay? It swims. Okay? It moves through the solution to the electrode surface somehow. Okay? How does it get there? Well, if the solution is perfectly quiet, it's going to diffuse. Okay? It's going to diffuse across a concentration gradient. I'll explain that a little bit more in a minute. So if it's a perfectly quiet solution, it has to go by diffusion. you can facilitate the process by stirring, okay, by causing convective mass transport. Okay, that can actually occur by stirring the solution or spinning the electrode, moving the electrode around. Okay, but somehow you've got to get the material to the electrode surface to react. The rate of the reaction is dependent on the supply of the material, the supply of the ions or molecules that are reacting. So, number one, the rate of any electrochemical reaction is dependent on the mass transport process, the rate or means by which the material gets to the electrode surface. Secondly, okay, the second thing that all of these reactions are dependent on, their rate is dependent on, is some intrinsic kinetics. Right? We know that if you were going to perform some reaction, pick a reaction, it has an intrinsic rate constant. And that rate constant is going to tell you how fast this reaction occurs. Now, the rate constant is a rate constant, so we can change some parameters, maybe temperature or things like that, that to speed the reaction up, but there's an intrinsic rate constant. Okay, and the rate constant could tell us that the reaction is incredibly fast and takes place in, you know, microseconds, or we could find out that the rate constant is incredibly slow. The reaction is incredibly slow. The rate constant is very small, and the reaction takes a long time to occur. It's the same with electrochemistry. It's the same. You just have to turn your conceptualization of reactions around a little bit. Because in electrochemistry, the funny thing is, see, in regular chemistry, right, in a bimolecular reaction, you have molecule A reacts with molecule B. You know, maybe they collide with one another and a reaction occurs and you get C. In the case of electrochemistry, it's molecule A and an electrode. There's no molecule B. It's an electrode surface. So it's going to come in contact with the electrode surface, and when it comes in contact with the electrode surface, it's either going to pick up an electron or it's going to lose an electron, one or the other, okay? And in the chemistry, the species is going to change. If it's iron 2 and it hits the electrode surface and loses an electron, it becomes iron 3, okay? So A becomes C, but it reacts with the electrode surface, not with another chemical species. That's sometimes a little unusual, a little different, because the problem is the electrode surface, we can't define it as chemists the way we do chemicals. It might be made of platinum, okay? It might be made of gold. It's a solid. Its actual ability to react depends on its history. In other words, is it clean? Is it oxidized on the surface? Is it polished smooth? Does the surface of the electrode very shiny and mirrored, polished, or is it very rough and rugged and beat up? It depends a lot on the surface of that electrode. What exactly occurs, or how rapidly it occurs, or to what extent it occurs. So it's a little bit more difficult to understand than a simple biomolecular reaction between A and B, because we know chemistry, we understand chemical species. When it comes to solids, we're not as good at dealing with solids as we are with solution species and things of that nature, gas phase reactions and so forth. Back to the point. The point is the rate is dependent on the kinetics, also dependent on the mass transport. So it says number two, kinetics of the electron transfer process. We refer to that as electrode kinetics. That's pretty basic. So we got mass transport and electrode kinetics. The electrode kinetics, in turn, depends on a couple of things, just like the mass transport depends on whether you're stirring or not stirring, you know, that kind of a thing. Well, the electrode kinetics depends on something. It depends on the nature of the reaction, right? Depends on what it is you're reacting. Some things react fast, some things react slow. It depends on what the electrode surface is. Is it a gold electrode? Is it a platinum electrode? Is it a carbon electrode? Is it a glassy carbon electrode? Is it a wax impregnated glassy, there's all sorts of electrodes. It depends on what that surface is, the nature of the surface, how fast the reaction is going to occur. So it depends on what the species is, nature of the reaction, the kind of oxidation, reduction, what it is you're oxidizing or reducing. It depends on the electrode itself. It depends on the temperature. All kinetics depends on temperatures, right? Temperature. You heat things up, they happen faster. You cool it down, it happens slower. We don't have a lot of control over these things in electrochemistry. Now, when it comes to the nature of the reaction, you're going to do what you're going to do, right? The boss says, do electrochemistry of copper. Yes, boss. Okay, you do it. You do electrochemistry of copper. You're stuck with that. So you're stuck with the nature of the reaction quite often. You could change the electrode material, but they are limited. Okay, limited materials that you can use for electrodes. So there's only a few things that are really good. Gold and platinum are really good. They're very inert materials, noble metals, and they work quite well for electrodes. Carbon, there are certain forms of carbon that work well as electrodes also. Beyond that, everything else becomes sort of esoteric. You know, in certain cases it works, some places it doesn't, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. All the rest of the stuff is not even worth talking about. Well, mercury, maybe. We'll talk about mercury. But, there are a handful of things that you're really going to be able to use for B, the electrode surface. And the temperature? Well, it's more convenient to work at room temperature. I could heat things up a little bit, I could cool them down a little bit, but there's going to be a pretty narrow range of temperatures, and room temperature, ambient temperature, is going to be the most convenient thing to work at. So, it turns out, we don't have a lot of control over number two. We're just stuck with it. Whatever the electrode kinetics are, we got a reaction, we got to do it, we only got a few electrodes we can choose from, and we're kind of stuck with ambient temperature, and so we don't have a lot of control over this. For that reason, we're going to have systems we just don't do by electrochemistry. Because, A, they don't react at all. You can't get the electro-inactive. They don't work. You just cannot make an oxidation or reduction reaction occur. Or, B, the kinetics are so slow that it's not worth waiting for. I can't deal with it. I gotta move on. I gotta do it by another method. I can't use the electrochemistry to measure this particular substance or do anything with this particular substance. So, we're gonna be stuck with certain things in electrochemistry. However, the mass, number one, mass transport, we can do a little bit about that. We can deal with that. And it becomes a variable in our system that we need to control. Let me talk to you about the modes of mass transport. There are three modes of mass transport. Sounds like an exam question, doesn't it? Three major modes of mass transport in solutions. Number one is migration. Okay, I'll call it mass transfer, mass transport. Okay, either one. But migration is one means of mass transport in solutions. It is movement of a charged particle in a potential field. It is the way that we get conductivity measurements. It is the way that electrophoresis is done. It is bad for electrochemistry. Electrophoresis is not electrochemistry. Okay, we are not converting something. We're just applying a potential field and causing species to migrate. You need migration in electrophoresis or it doesn't work. You need migration for conductivity measurements or they don't work. Migration just means I put in two electrodes, apply a potential, and I cause the movement of charged species. So positively charged things are attracted to the negative electrode. Negatively charged things are attracted to the positive electrode, and I cause them to migrate in the solution. In electrochemistry, this is a bad thing, okay, because it's not easily defined or controlled. Now you say, wait, we control it in electrophoresis. Yes, but it's a little bit difficult to control. And so migration is not used as a means of mass transport in voltammetry or conventional electrochemistry. We can get rid of migration by throwing in other ions. Right? If it's migration of a charged species in a potential field, if I throw in a whole bunch of other charged species, then they'll all do the migrating, and the thing that I'm interested in won't migrate much. So if I add a 100-fold excess of some other ion, so if I have a cation, I was talking about iron before, iron 2, I don't want it to migrate. I'm applying a potential to my electrodes, so there's a potential field in my electrochemical cell. My iron would migrate if it was the only ion present. However, I throw in a 100-fold excess of some other ions, sodium ions, potassium ions, whatever, and they migrate, and the iron doesn't migrate as much. If I add a 100-fold excess, then I get 1/100th of the migration of the iron that I had without the 100-fold excess of the inert electrolyte. If I add 1,000-fold excess, I get 0.1% migration. So I minimize the migration of the ion of interest by putting in some other ions into the system. And that's all there is to it. They're called an inert electrolyte because they are not electrochemically active. They are not undergoing an electrochemical reaction like the species that I'm interested in. Right? Make sense? Very simple. So migration is one means of mass transport. It is the bad means of mass transport. No migration. Okay? Bad boy. Now, the second means of mass transport is diffusion. I already mentioned, referred to diffusion a little while ago. And diffusion is movement of a species due to a concentration gradient. Doesn't require it to be an ion. Okay? Molecules will diffuse. It's based on a concentration gradient. I often use the example of it, that I got in, you know, fifth grade science or whatever it was, where they took a glass of water. Okay, they took a glass of water, nice clear water, and they took a piece of tissue paper, okay, like a paper or something, and they put a few crystals of a dye into that tissue. Okay? And they rolled it up to conceal the dye, and they dropped it into the glass of water. Okay, and they let the glass of water stirs, you know, mixes it up a little bit, but after a while the convection that's in there dies down, and the system becomes very quiet, no movement of the solution, and little by little the chemwife, the tissue in the bottom, gets wet, saturated with water, and the dye crystals begin to dissolve. And out of the tissue comes little wisps of dye. Now, in the experiment that we did, it was blue dye. You can use whatever color you want. But the blue dye started to come out of the... but there's no stirring, yet the molecules of dye were diffusing because out in the bulk of the water, there was a dye concentration of zero. Inside the tissue, there was a very, very high concentration. I don't know what it is, but it's some high concentration of dye molecules dissolved in water. So they're gradually diffusing. What's the driving force? Concentration gradient. Very high concentration to very low concentration. If we want to get back to physical chemistry, it's a free energy difference. Okay, it's a free energy difference, but physical chemistry makes people nauseous, especially this early in the morning. So we won't talk about it. But the point is that molecules diffuse under a concentration gradient. If you leave the glass of water long enough, it becomes completely blue, if you use blue dye. And the concentration of the dye is equal at all points, everywhere in the solution. Okay? And in the little tissue, it's no higher than it is at the surface of the glass or wherever you measure. So diffusion is a real thing, and molecules are moving under a concentration gradient to alleviate or remove that concentration gradient. All right? Now, in electrochemistry, what happens is, remember the little example I was using, today will be iron day. I used iron 2, and I oxidized the iron 2 to iron 3. If it takes place at the electrode surface, and the iron 2, which touches the electrode surface, becomes converted to iron 3, what's the concentration of iron 2? It's zero, because we converted the iron 2 to iron 3. There's no more iron 2 there. And so, to replace the iron 2 that we just converted to iron 3, molecules, or ions in this case, of iron 2 must diffuse to replace the iron 2 that was converted to iron 3. What's the concentration of, if I start with a solution that is 100% or has a, let's say water with some concentration of iron 2, there's no iron 3 in the system. I turn the electrode on and a little bit of the iron 2 gets converted to iron 3. The concentration of iron 3 in the rest of the solution is zero. But at the electrode surface, it's high, because I just made iron 3 at the electrode surface by converting iron 2 to iron 3. What's going to happen to the iron 3 that was made at the electrode surface? It's going to diffuse out into the solution against a concentration gradient, right? There's a concentration gradient, zero in the solution, high at the electrode surface. This is how diffusion works in electrochemistry. In the form of a diagram, okay, if we have a reaction, I was using iron, but let's use a reaction of an analyte molecule, A, to a product molecule, P, okay. A is, in this case, reduced. The example I was giving you was oxidation. Doesn't matter. It can be reduction's okay. So here we're going to add an electron to A, convert A to P. So in this beginning of the experiment, I've got only A in my system. The concentration, this is a graph of concentration, versus distance from the electrode surface. The electrode could be this way, could be this way, could be this way. Okay, could be in my ear, but it's an electrode, okay? And it has an applied distance from the electrode surface along the x-axis and concentration on the y-axis. If I have, at the beginning of the experiment, before anything happens, all I got is A. It's some concentration, and the concentration of the product, P, zero. There's none of it. I've not made any yet. I didn't turn the power on yet. Okay? So I got all A, no P, electrode, flip the switch, turn on the juice, I begin to electrolyze the solution. Right? I'm applying a potential sufficient to convert A to P by reduction. Gain an electron, convert it to P. It could be the iron 3 going to iron 2. Or any other reaction that you would prefer. What happens in the solution is shown here in the second panel. We still have concentration, we still have distance from the electrode surface. After some period of time, let's call it 1 millisecond, the concentration of A at the surface of the electrode, which was uniform throughout the solution and at the surface it was high, is gone to zero. Why? Because A has been converted to P at the electrode surface. Some distance away from the electrode surface, it's still at the same concentration it was before. In between the unknown distance, we actually have numbers down here, it's in millimeters times 10 to the third, I guess that's microns, then in between there's a gradient from zero up to whatever that maximum concentration was. So, at some time, and in this case I'm saying 1 millisecond after I flip the switch on, there is a concentration gradient, zero at the electrode surface. Why zero? Because every molecule of A that hits the electrode surface gets converted immediately to P, and the concentration remains zero at the electrode surface. Some distance away, it's still at the same concentration it was. In between, there's a gradient because things are diffusing across that gradient. They're diffusing from the bulk solution to the electrode surface, but they're getting used up. So all the in between here, all the stuff's been used up. Now, that's the case for A. What's the case for P? It's the inverse or opposite case for P. For P, there's a diffusion away from the electrode surface. In the beginning, I had no P. Okay? I turn on the electrode system, I turn the power on, and the concentration of P goes shooting up to some high value. I don't know what it is. Some value. And out in the bulk solution, it's still zero. Out here, it's still zero. In between, there's a gradient of product P diffusing away from the electrode surface out into nowhere land where there's no product. At some time other than 1 millisecond, let's call it 5 milliseconds, the system looks similar, but the concentration gradient has changed a little bit, and the layer of depleted A reaches further out into the solution. At 10 milliseconds, that depletion of A reaches further out into the solution, some greater distance. Now, these distances are small distances. We're talking about, many molecular layers, but it's still small distances, right? I mean, molecules are, angstrom-sized things, right? And we may, if you start to talk about, we can talk about ions like iron or lead or things like that, or we can talk about molecules. They'll undergo electrochemistry also. We could have a nitrobenzene being reduced to aniline. You know what aniline is? Aniline is a benzene ring with a NH2 on it, okay? And the electrochemical reaction of nitrobenzene and aniline being interconverted one electrochemically. You can do that reaction. So it's not just an ion or a small molecule, but it can be a larger molecule. These things, right, the bond lengths for these different bonds are on the order of angstroms. The distances here are on the order of microns, okay? 10 to the minus 6th, all right? Angstroms 10 to the minus 10th meters. We're talking meters, right? So there's many layers of molecules in here, okay, that this diffusion is taking place across, all right? But you understand the concept. Stuff is being depleted at the electrode surface, and that depletion is extending away as more things diffuse to the electrode surface and get converted. As the product is formed, it diffuses out into the bulk solution, and we have this situation which is referred to as concentration polarization. Polarization means you got two poles, right? One is two extremes, the high concentration in the bulk solution, the low concentration at the surface, if we're talking about analyte species A, or if we're talking about product, we have high concentration at the electrode surface and low concentration out in the solution. It's polarized. There's a broad gradient. Zero is as low as you can get. Okay, and so whatever the high concentration is versus zero, we have a concentration gradient that causes diffusion to occur and is the driving force for this form of mass transport in electrochemistry. All right. What can we say about it? We can say that there was a man named Fick. Fick was a mathematical sort of person, and Fick described diffusion by Fick's laws. Okay? He came along and he said, we can describe diffusion mathematically by an equation that says that there's a flux of material. Okay, so the material is moving. Let's say we're talking about the product. We're forming it at the electrode surface, and it's diffusing away from the electrode surface, so there's a flux of material emanating from the electrode surface. It's being produced here, and it's diffusing based on this concentration polarization, and there's a flux of material. It's the moles of material passing a 1 centimeter squared plane. So Fick drew a 1 centimeter squared plane. Okay, he just said, okay, here's a little plane, and we'll just make this hypothetical 1 centimeter squared plane in space in my solution. And it's the moles of material that are passing through that 1 centimeter square plane that I'm going to describe or define as my flux in the system, the flux of material that's being diffused or is diffusing. Then Fick came up with the idea that there's something called a diffusion coefficient, that the big benzene molecule, benzene, right, nitrobenzene and aniline molecules, are much bigger than the little iron molecule, iron ion. Okay? So you can have big things and little things. Big things move slowly. Little things are quick, like Speedy Gonzales, you know? And so the big things are moving slowly. They have a diffusion coefficient that says they only move so many centimeters per second, whereas the little things are moving much greater number of centimeters per second. Okay, so the flux is dependent on the intrinsic diffusion coefficient of the species of interest. Now, guess what? It's not just how big the thing is, but what it's moving through. Okay, if we were moving through molasses, okay, or glycerin, some very viscous material, we would move more slowly. If we're moving through a material that is not very viscous, we can move faster. So diffusion coefficients are dependent not only on the size of the molecule, but also on the viscosity of the solution. Right? So just to give you an idea, these are, again, concepts you can maybe grasp. So flux is dependent on the diffusion coefficient of the species that we're talking about. And then there's this little term here that is based on concentration. So it's, you know, we got some got to do some math here. We got to do a little partial differentiation here. What are we going to differentiate with respect to? Well, distance, right? We're concerned about the distance, and we're concerned about time, right? How fast we're concerned about the flux of material, and there's an intrinsic diffusion coefficient for this material, but it's going to diffuse some distance in some time. Right, so time in seconds from when the power is turned on, x is distance from the electrode surface in centimeters. So we've got the change in the concentration of this, it's changing. The concentration is changing, and then we have the change in distance, or at different distances, or at different locations, and then we have that's going to be a function of the concentration is a function of the distance and the time. So this is Fick's first law. And it defines not just electrochemistry, but lots of things. Right? It applies to a lot of systems where we're doing anything in chemistry where we deal with molecules diffusing, we can probably apply Fick's law. It's very important in electrochemistry. So, let's see. Using an expression for conservation of mass, we can take the conservation of mass just says that nothing, no matter is created or destroyed, everybody's got to be somewhere. That's my version of the conservation of mass. Okay, everybody's got to be somewhere, and so if it's not here, it's there. All right, it's somewhere else. So the change in concentration or the change in time has to do with the flux over distance, and that's basically an expression that deals with conservation of mass. You combine that with Fick's first law, you get his second law. Okay, his second law deals with time, right? Deals more with time, and there's involved a second differential. We can solve Fick's laws. We're not going to do the rigorous derivation of it. But we can understand it by talking about boundary conditions. When you solve any of these kinds of problems, you have to deal with initial and boundary conditions. And that's what this slide is all about. For electrochemistry, we can set up an initial condition and some boundary conditions. The initial condition, very simple, is that the concentration of a species at some location, X, at time zero, okay, is C. So we're talking about probably species A, right? Remember, A plus an electron goes to P. If we wanted to, we could call this the concentration of A at any x, and at time zero is some fixed value, right? So in that diagram that I showed you, the concentration of A was constant everywhere at all values of x at time zero, only at time zero. okay? Only at time zero, before we started, before we did anything, the concentration is the same everywhere. All right, so that's what this is telling you in words. Then there's boundary conditions. We've got two extremes of boundary conditions, right? We've got the boundary condition when we turn the switch on, right? So let's call it, let's look at the electrode surface. That's x equals zero, right? We're starting our measurement of distance from the electrode surface. And at some time t, that's not zero. So once I flip the switch on, I'm at all times other than zero. I'm at some time other than zero. So I'm at a value of t, but I'm at a distance. Let's start with one boundary. That's the distance. That's the boundary at the electrode surface. X is equal to zero. We're at the surface of the electrode. What happens at boundary one? The concentration of A goes to zero. A gets all used up at the electrode surface. It's reduced. It gains an electron. It becomes P. It disappears. It vanishes. Okay, it's no longer there. So the one boundary, one extreme, is the zero concentration at the electrode surface. So that's one boundary condition. At times greater than zero, the condition I'm setting up here is that A is zero. Its concentration is zero at all times greater than zero. Make sense? Should make sense. Think about it. Boundary condition two, at some distance, x, which is infinity, so anything greater than any large distance, infinity is just a large number, right? Well, it's a concept. But it's at some distance far from the electrode surface, away from the gradient that we had, and some time t, so any time greater than zero, at some large distance away, there's going to be a finite concentration value for the concentration of the species. So we've got two boundary conditions, right? We've got the zero at the electrode surface and probably the initial concentration at boundary two at some infinite distance away from the electrode. We plug those boundary and initial conditions into Fick's law and we come up with the Cottrell equation. Yeah, it says the Cottrell equation. Okay, this is one of the more fundamental equations for voltammetry. Two M's in voltammetry. Okay. Try that in your spell checker. It gives us a fundamental equation. Now we do have to include some of the electrochemical equations, some electrochemical relationships into this, along with Fick's law, but it tells us that the current that is produced, right, current is electron flow, electrons flowing in the system, caused by an oxidation or reduction reaction. The current in the system is a flux of electrons. Current is just a flux of electrons, a flow of electrons. The flux of electrons is related to the rate at which the reaction occurs. The rate at which the reaction occurs is related to the mass transport or the flux of material in the electrochemical cell. It's moving in the electrochemical cell. So the current, I, is equal to N, number of electrons, F, Faraday's constant, moles, basically moles of electrons. It's a conversion factor between moles of a species and electrons, and so based on the charge. And so then there's the area of the electrode. That's the surface over which the molecules are reacting. The concentration, you know, what we called Ca before, and then the square root of the diffusion coefficient of A, pi, and the time t, because time influences that concentration gradient or that region over which things are changing. The Cottrell equation basically says that I can tell you what the concentration of the species is, okay, at any time, okay, based on the current and a bunch of constants like pi, the diffusion coefficient for the species that's involved in the diffusion, the area of the electrode, Faraday, and so forth. Right? So there's really, in terms of experimental parameters, the boss comes to you and says, I want you to do chemistry of iron. I want you to do electrochemistry with iron. And you say, okay, I'm stuck with iron. So I've got some, I can make up the system with some concentration. Okay? I have an electrode that has some area. Okay? F is F. N is N. If it's iron 2 to iron 3, it's 1. N is equal to 1. And pi is pi. The species that has some diffusion coefficient. So I can deal with the system by saying at some time I can measure a current that is indicative of the concentration. Right? So this equation defines diffusion control electrochemistry or electrochemistry of the voltammetric type. All right. What else we got here? Here's the experiment. The experiment is I'm going to measure the voltage in my system, or I'm going to apply a voltage. All right, so here's what happens. I apply a voltage. Let's say I apply voltage 1, V1. V1 doesn't convert the species the way the iron 2 to iron 3 or whatever I'm doing. It doesn't do it. It's not enough. So as time goes by, this is time, right, on these axes, voltage is on this axis. I got some voltage. Nothing's happening. I jack the voltage up. I say, man, I gotta get this thing going. I turn it up, okay, and I go to V2. V2 becomes a voltage at which I convert iron 2 to iron 3. We say it's an oxidation of iron 2 to iron 3. Okay, and I hold the voltage constant at that value. What's happening in the system? Well, that's what's down here. This is current I, or capital I used before, either one, okay, versus time. When the voltage is insufficient to cause the reaction, nothing's happening. When I get to the point where I turn the voltage up to a value that will cause the reaction to occur, all of a sudden I begin to see a curve of this shape. Okay, the current is high initially and then drops off with time. Why is that? Because I'm using up stuff. I'm using up the stuff that's right next to the electrode, and I'm depleting the solution further and further away from the electrode as things diffuse in and react. That's all that's going on here. If I were to take the Cottrell equation, right, this equation, I could fit it to this curve right here. Time is one of the parameters in the Cottrell equation. Current is one of the parameters in the Cottrell equation. And I would be able to determine this concentration profile or current time profile based on the Cottrell.